Good evening, everyone. I don't know about Sacramento, but it quite suddenly cooled off here. It's not quite 70 degrees, whereas around noon it was like 85, which is kind of strange. But anyway, I don't mind a bit. I hope you're all reasonably comfortable where you are. A few years ago, when I was at Tassajara, I was in Mountain Center. During the summer, and that year also, there was a fire. There were fires everywhere, and in fact, that was the summer fire nearly took Tassajara away. And finally, after some while, we could return to Tassajara, and the weather was quite hot still, and the air was very poor quality, and so all of us didn't return, but a fair number of us did. And that night, we were sitting in the Zendo together, and we had closed all the windows. So it was quite close in there. I don't know if you've been in the Tassajara Zendo, but sitting in there in hot weather and all the windows shut and smoke everywhere. It was, you wouldn't think that was ideal. And yet, I remember sitting there and I really, after a few minutes, I wanted to shout. Because the sense of our practice was so strong. And straightforward mind, straightforward heart was filled the Zendo in spite of our discomfort, or I don't know, because of. Anyway, it was quite amazing, and I still remember that. The instruction, our instruction is we should take some care with our practice place. It shouldn't be too hot or too cold. Dogen says, it shouldn't be too bright or too dark, and the atmosphere, the air should be healthy if possible. So that's ideal, but it's important to not just believe, but to notice that even when that's not the case, even when the circumstances aren't ideal, the body-mind plants itself in its Dharma position. And our actual nature expresses itself completely in that stillness, in the midst of heat and smoke and goodness knows what else. This is quite liberating. However, that's not what I was going to talk about. And I try not to have the same topic for any two Dharma talks. long ago, I set myself that kind of exercise. But sometimes it can't be helped. So the topic I brought up on Saturday last when I spoke at my temple here, One Mountain Temple in San Francisco, is still in my mind. So I kind of have to talk about it again. However, I don't think any of you were at the talk on Saturday here, so it probably doesn't matter. I've spoken before, I think, about how Shakyamuni Buddha, in his many teachings, he doesn't use the word love. He uses a number of other terms. He certainly uses maitri or friendliness. He uses karuna or compassion. But there isn't any particular word that easily translates as love, even though some people will translate maitri as love. I think that's not quite right. However, recently, I found myself carried to the conclusion that the basis of the Bodhisattva vow is, in fact, love. And when I said that on Saturday, a little voice was saying, I never dreamed I would ever hear myself say that. Now, some of you don't know me, so maybe that doesn't seem so surprising, but some of you who do may be amazed. But when we consider the Bodhisattva vow in its immense grandeur, if we try to sense, if we try to understand what could possibly be the fuel or the engine, it has to be, I think, love. Now, there's a tricky bit here. On Saturday, I had to confess to people that I don't think that I actually had ever experienced true love, whatever that is. I don't think so, somehow. In our Western culture, love is kind of it's a kind of a murky concept. I think sometimes we have the reaction, well, I may not be able to define it, but I know it when I see it. Which is like, okay, that's sort of like pornography. People say that. You know? It's like, okay, well. Most of our thinking around love tends to put it in the class of feelings. Love is a feeling. But when you start to look at it very carefully, it becomes harder and harder to actually characterize that in a way that is very, very stable, let alone kind of universally acceptable. So I've been thinking that love does not exclude feelings. However, love is what generates and moves our body minds in the field of a vow to save all sentient beings from suffering. And that, from my point of view, completely escapes from the bounds of any particular feeling. Am I making any sense at all? It's much easier if there's a room of people instead of the Hollywood Squares thing here.
It's thought provoking. It makes sense.
Oh. So what now when I say sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them. The resonance in my own body mind is, yeah, that is actually love. And it's, you know, it's not some particular feeling or how I felt about that partner or my first boyfriend or any of that. It's not that that's excluded, but it's not that. It is much, much vaster than that. And in fact, it is the only thing that could possibly support the Bodhisattva vow. Not just lifetime after lifetime, but universe after universe after universe. So I've been very humbled by that. And by my inability to, you know, to grasp that. It remains ungraspable and incredibly, with incredible vitality. And For a while, I tried to escape from this conclusion. And I tried to think, oh, that must be something else, you know. Well, what else would support an intention to save all sentient beings? Well, that's a nice thing. It's a good thing to do. Save all sentient beings. It's very grand. Yes, very good. But that is not enough. Or, well, you know, Buddha said that's a good thing. Like, that's not enough. There has to be a massive motive force behind such a vow. And I think the only phenomenon that qualifies is love. So I say this as someone who frequently sneers at the way love appears in Western Dharma discourses. Now, I know it's a real crowd pleaser, but often my reaction was, rather cynical, and hearing such discourses, I would cross my arms and grumble to myself. Yeah, well, Buddha never talked about love, and grumble. Notwithstanding the fact that my teacher, with some frequency for some years, has been talking about love. And whenever he did, it would set my teeth on edge. Now I think I have skated free from that somehow. So, I don't have a car, but if I did, I'm thinking of various bumper stickers I could have. Bodhisattvas do it with love. You know, something like that. There's a great market there. Now, mind you, I'm by necessity, I am avoiding saying what love is. So I'm kind of defining it by pointing to the Bodhisattva vow with its great engine of love. I'm saying that's what love is. But beyond that, I'm not defining it because I can't. And then just today, I was thinking of Jesus, and his fairly frequent use of the word, but without defining it. And when he says, you know, a kind of a, it's almost a different flavor of the Bodhisattva vow. And he says, I want you to love each other as I have loved you. He doesn't say what that is. And the impression I get is not that it was a big gushy feeling. I want you all to have a big gushy feeling for each other, as I've had a big gushy feeling for you. It's like, no, it doesn't work. So Jesus didn't define it either. And then I thought of, oh, how about the Apostle Paul? If some of you are disappointed that I am drawing on Christian sources, I will be as brief as possible. And the nice thing about this arrangement is you can turn off your headphones or, you know, shut your laptop for a minute. But I did want to mention this famous passage, which all of you have probably heard at least once in the first epistle to the Corinthians, from the Apostle Paul, chapter 13. Now, here is Paul. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, it always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. And then this curious verse here. He says, love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. I thought that was quite fascinating to discover that the Apostle Paul, he says what love does, he says what it doesn't do, but he does not say what it is. This is fascinating. So when he says love never fails, it's like, oh, we're in the same universe as the Bodhisattva vow. That is the love that is being talked about. So this, from this point of view, the literature of the Bodhisattva path takes on a very interesting cast, very interesting set of colors. Pardon. And when we look at the Bodhisattva literature, for instance, or when I do now, I see it as a literature of love, which again is something I never thought I would hear myself say. And again, a lot of you don't know me so well. But some of the people who are listening to my talk Saturday said, three or four of them who were listening to the talk, and there was a little bit of static, and they were each going to like send a little chat note to say, oh, there's a little static. And they all, these are separate people, right? These are not together. These are all in their little cubicle like you are. And they all froze because they all said they were thinking, I have never heard him talk like this. I don't want to miss any of this. I'll just let the static be there. So this has very much been on my mind and in my heart for some while now. And having come to this development in my relationship to the practice of the Bodhisattva path, I felt like I had to talk about it. It even puts our Zen literature, our Zen campfire tales, all our Zen stories into a kind of a different context. You know, if those campfires are all love stories, boy, that's really looking different now. All those nose pinchings and ear tweakings and shouting and stuff. If those are all love stories, that's pretty amazing. So as followers of the Bodhisattva path, that is what is carrying us. That is the onrushing stream. That we have entered and is moving us towards liberation for all beings. So again, this is quite humbling. And I think of the Apostle Paul saying, where there are tongues, they will be stilled. And I often feel that way. I feel a mysterious and sacred silence. So against this background, a remark such as the Tang Dynasty master Xuanzha made looks kind of different. He's the one who said, the entire universe in 10 directions is a single bright pearl. Kind of gives it a different twist than I was accustomed to noticing. Well, maybe you have some comments or questions. I don't like to go on too long blathering at people.
I have a comment and a question.
Is that Oscar?
Yes, it is.
There you are. Hi, Oscar.
Hi. Thank you for this interesting talk. So, which makes a lot of sense to me. I'm not, that sounds right. Something that comes to mind, this is the comment, is recollection of how I felt when it came to me, or I was taught, I should say, that the juice of the paramitas is because they're reflecting the way the universe actually is. That universe actually is generous, patient, kind, respectful, patient, and so forth. And that's always made a lot of sense to me. It's been, you know, sort of foundational for me that, that's how I want to be. And it occurs to me, or it immediately occurred to me when you talked of the power of love and its foundational function, with the Bodhisattva way, that God, as I've read on big rocks along the highway, God is love. The universe is love. And I don't know what that means any more than, you know, maybe what the Apostle Paul said. But it seems like my intuition, my belief, it seems quite certain to me, is that we're tapping when love is flowing, we're tapping into that Ginsberg had a line in it, I think, in Howell, tapping into the dynamo of the sky or something. So that's just my thought on it. And it sits, so your teaching sits, I don't know, it just sits really well with me. That makes a lot of sense. My question is on another topic, a more traditional Zen topic. Is it okay if I bring that up?
Sure.
So I'm asking for clarification of the Buddhist teachings on consciousness. In regard to Buddhist teaching to Bahia, with regard to the seeing, there will only be the seeing and so forth. Does that mean with regard to the seeing, there is no eye consciousness at such a time?
Well, what I think it means is that when there is eye consciousness, there is only eye consciousness. It is.
Mm-hmm. So eye consciousness per se in the Buddhist...
By the way, you mean capital I, you don't mean eyeball.
No, I do mean right. Eyeball.
Oh, you mean eyeball. Okay.
Yeah, eye consciousness of the six consciousnesses.
Yes, I see. Yes, when there is eyeball consciousness, it is just eyeball consciousness, period.
So then from that answer, I understand that eyeball consciousness has no linkage with ego consciousness, the you of which Buddha was speaking when he spoke, there is no you there.
Yeah. Yeah. He says, when for you in eye consciousness, there is only eye consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There is no additional self.
What is eye consciousness as separate from seeing?
There isn't eye consciousness separate from seeing, in my understanding.
Okay.
In other words, there is the organ, the object, and the capacity we call consciousness. And all of those three elements must be present if there is what we call seeing. That's the technical expression. So I don't know if this is too technical for our get together here, but if you feel like sending me an email, I will reply.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Oscar. I can't necessarily see everyone's hands, so I see
Larry's hand.
Larry, I see Linda, I see Jim, and we'll get to Barbara. We'll see if we can get to everybody here. Larry, I think I saw you first.
Thank you, Mio. I enjoyed your talk. I recently attended 8 days listening to a Dzogchen Rinpoche helping his students out with their meditation practice. And your subject came up, and of course, you know, Dzogchen, it's Mahayana practice.
Yep.
And this Rinpoche, during the course of describing the process of non-dual aware, resting in non-dual awareness, meditate, very similar, right, to Zen, objectless meditation, said this: things open up through this process. Okayness is part of innate nature, transformation to love, not love of a particular thing, just love, okayness. This is called essence love. This is the seed of loving kindness practice. Such freedom, joy, happiness is all unconditioned, not focused on anything outwardly, not dependent. It just is.
Mm-hmm.
And what you were saying reminded me of, you know, a little bit like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sure. Oh, heavens. Let's see, Barbara, maybe?
I thank you so much for your lovely talk. Lovely talk, I'd love. And I'm just reminded of all of the bodhisattvas in our midst these days. Mm. All of the people who are giving service during the fires, during the pandemic, and other calamities before us. Not, you know, we've thought of them as being courageous people, but I think perhaps courage is another action like patience, and that it emanates from love, mm-hmm. the result of love. So we have many examples of bodhisattvas driven, fueled by love around us today.
Yes. Thank you. Linda, did you have a hand? I've already lost complete track of...
I did.
You did, okay.
I'm not resisting thinking of it that way, except that I just have always, I guess, thought of the engine of the bodhisattva vow being compassion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to me, those are such kind of inner overlapping
yeah.
concepts. I just wonder if you have anything, any comment on that.
Well, I guess taking a cue from Apostle Paul, I would say love is compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. As one of the many things that it does or how it acts, it is compassionate. So I agree.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. I know Jim had a question or comment. Dave, looks like. Jim, do you want to go ahead? Or?
Yeah, I'll go ahead. Right.
Okay.
Am I unmuted? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I heard you say your insight here was based on your insight was that the only thing that could be the engine of something so vast as the bodhisattva vow, your insight was, well, what could possibly be the engine of something so vast? And your conclusion, what came to you was that love is the only thing you could think of. And what I was thinking, what made me think of was Martin Luther King, who I think had the same insight And he looked at the vastness of racism. Mm. He looked at the vastness of oppression. And the only thing that he could think of that was powerful enough, that was a big enough engine to meet that force, was love.
Mm-hmm.
It was the only thing that he could think of. And so it came, I feel your insight is like very similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It might be a challenging question. You know, where is love when you're on a march for racial justice and you get clubbed in the head? It's like, well, I'm going to say it's still there, but I may not have a feeling at that moment that I would label love. So that's the only footnote I'd throw out there. It doesn't always manifest as a feeling that I could call, oh, look, there's love. I love you. Hit me again. It's like, no, I can't. I'm not going there. So that's where the vastness comes in somehow. Dave, did you want to speak?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the talk. You're reading from Corinthians, and it occurred to me that in large part, Paul was talking about love without really defining it, the aspects of it, in much the same way as Lao Tzu talked about the Tao.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of went through my head that, I don't know if it's a real inference or what, that the Tao is love. And that, there is your great force of the universe, your God is love.
Uh-huh.
The only thing that can stand up to the oppression is this overriding force of the universe. And if we tap into that, then maybe we can say the Bodhisattva vow and actually think maybe there's a chance of pulling it off.
Yeah, yeah. You remind me of course, the beginning of the Tao Te Ching. And maybe I can paraphrase it slightly and say, the love that you can call love, that's not love. It escapes that, but that's what it is. Yeah, thank you.
Mio, there's a blue hand from John Bartlett.
Okay.
Very patiently.
Hi,
John. Please.
Yeah. I'm new here.
Oh, there you are. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, I'm new here, but as you were talking. What I kept thinking of is I was thinking of consider the journey of someone towards enlightenment. So taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then assuming the effectiveness of that, eventually attaining enlightenment and seeing that the only thing that was holding them in prison was ignorance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the feeling of joy that they would experience at that release from the constraints that had held them before.
Mm-hmm.
And then looking at the world around them and seeing a world of people held by constraints and suffering, and yet that constraint is not... It's the substance of the constraint is wrongly held views or ignorance. Mm-hmm. And so they are chains of gossamer, right?
Yes.
And if you think of someone, you know, all of us probably have had a loved one or someone who has passed or has suffered with illness or cancer or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And you think the degree and the distances that we'd be willing to go to help them, to prolong their life or to heal them and bring them back to health. And with something like cancer, you can imagine the difficulty of it. The tremendous resources that have to be expended to make any sort of difference with that. But then in this case, the tremendous suffering in the world because of ignorance, and given that one has understanding, the ease with which it can be removed. Hmm. So if Buddha can cause enlightenment by raising up a flower, right? Hmm. Or just a few well-chosen words through skillful means. If you could do that, if you had the power to remove that suffering with such ease, right? And even if it wasn't easy, even if there was, you could say, a huge karmic burden that you had to work through for a particular person to get them to understand, knowing that that constraint was just this thin chain of gossamer, wouldn't you want to remove it? Mm-hmm. Like it just, and the other thing to say is, look, imagine for yourself you had that power to remove that suffering. What kind of person would you be if you turned your back on those people?
Mm-hmm. Right?
And so it just seems like a natural expression,
yeah,
of what a person would do given that consciousness.
Mm-hmm. With that understanding. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I was thinking of the example of the protest and getting clubbed in the head. And I think what is a given, at some, maybe not even a given, but what is likely is there will be pain in that moment. But one thing I'm pretty sure is there doesn't have to be hatred.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I just thought that was interesting. And I thank you for the talk.
Thank you for your comment. I think my Hollywood Squares thing here has got everybody in it at this point. So if there are one or two more questions, we could continue or we can stop now. Oh, Karen. Uh-huh.
Thank you, Mio, for that lovely talk. Mm-hmm. I maybe have missed this. I think I have two questions. One is, do you know what it was that maybe happened recently, or is it like, you know, does the being kind of in lockdown, does it have anything to do with your coming to this new understanding?
Hmm.
And I guess the other thing that I was wondering, I guess if the engine of Buddha's understanding wasn't love, what would it be then? Or what did you think it was prior to coming to this conclusion?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I'm imagining maybe it was just like, well, that it's just the truth, you know, it's the truth as things are, or something mm-hmm. like that. But, so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It would be hard to point at this moment to this or that circumstance as the source or something of this changed perspective. It would be hard to point to any particular thing. It may well be that the kind of semi-contemplative life that everyone's been ushered into by circumstances was part of the process, maybe. But I can't really point to any particular thing. And this is all still relatively new. This is the past month, maybe. So I don't, not sure how things may continue to evolve or change. But right now, this is rather mysterious. And as to what did I used to think? I think it was something like, well, the vow itself is the engine. So something maybe more like intention, perhaps. And it, just recently, I started to feel like, no, that's not enough. That won't do it. There has to be something else. So that's how things stand at the moment with me, I guess I'd say.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I don't see any other waving hands, so maybe it's an okay time to stop. And thank you all for coming to this virtual Dharma assembly. Please continue to have confidence in your practice.